nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So today we have Professor Jim Leary here, who's one of our Purdue faculty. And I guess the title's obvious, but he's going to be talking about optical biomems. And Jim has the office next to me. My main research office is in Burke. And he has all these great mechanical engineering problems. And so that's why I invited him over here to talk about this. I think you'll see, you all have copies of the bio. He's got a fairly unique path to where he is today. So, you know, he's got a bachelor's in aerospace and a PhD in biophysics. He's had two appointments at medical schools, and now he's got an appointment here in basic medical sciences and also in BME. Right? Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, I'd like to welcome Jim Leary.
All right. Well, they've got me completely wired here, so I'm not going to go very far. Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you today. And I interact with quite a few mechanical engineering students, not only in Steve's lab, but also in a few other labs. So I'm gradually getting on more and more thesis committees here. I think I'm on 17 of them at the moment. So what I thought I would do today is pick talk a little bit about a subset of my research, and I'll point out to you what parts I'm talking about and what parts I'm not talking about. And you say, why talk about the things that you're not talking about? Because there's a lot of things that might be of interest to people that we can talk about after the seminar. Part of this is to get to know what some of the things that I'm doing and to interact on that basis. So I'm going to try to limit the talk today to what I think would be of most interest to you. And in particular, as Steve said, I'm going to talk about basically portable point-of-care biomems devices, and I'll show you some sort of the theoretical problems we have. And as he said, I'm always eager to have lots of help because I get into a lot of different complex projects, and we certainly have a lot of mechanical engineering problems here to do. So as part of this, I'm going to talk about essentially a handheld flow cytometer blood analyzer that we're developing, including developing this, assuming NASA still flies in 2 years. This will be flying up to the International Space Station for applications. So we're busy, just got a phase two grant to build that. I'm also going to talk, this is a flow-through device. This is a hybrid flow imaging device with capture plates on here and a hybrid optical surface plasmon resonance and fluorescence imaging device. And as I said, I live in the Burke and also the Bindley Bioscience Center. And if I describe what I do, it's really engineering from the macro to the micro to the nanoscale. So we really do multi-scale engineering in my lab, as well as a lot of biomedical applications. We have a fairly sophisticated cell and molecular biology facility, and as a result of that, we're able to do a lot of things in-house. And I'll talk about some of those applications here in just a few minutes. So before you get overwhelmed by this, my graduate students hate this slide because they're all numbered here and what their different projects and how they're supposed to be. Everybody works on multiple projects in my lab. But what I wanted to show you is two things of that. One is that we have sort of three general areas, bio-nanotechnology, and I'm more or less in charge of the bio-nano area as the faculty in charge at the Burke Nanotechnology Center. And then we have a lot of bioinstrumentation over in the Bindley, and I run a core facility for the university and the IU and Purdue Clinical Translational Science Institute. And then we do a lot of biological applications, and these come from my medical background, so I have a pretty good feel for where some of the problems are. Now, what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to start out by talking about high-throughput flow cytometry, and then show you how that has gone from very, very large, complex, expensive devices, literally in the million-dollar range, that I've designed and built as part of my research over the last 30 years, down to something that is basically handheld. So microfluidic cytometers. And then as part of that, we'll be doing a point-of-care blood analysis with that. And that's the first set of applications. And then to do sort of a very different type of point-of-care device, I'm going to show you our BioMEMS surface plasmon resonance and fluorescence imaging, which is getting down into the microbial era. And then here we're talking about detection of various types of microbial pathogens. And I'll show two applications, one in food pathogen testing and the other, a future one that we're just starting into for doctor's offices, point of care for nose and throat assays in the doctor's office. So there's a lot of things I'm not going to talk about. One, and I'll just mention them in fleeting as I go through my talk. But we make, when I say make things all the way from the macro scale down to the nanoscale, today I'm going to talk mostly about the micro scale, but we do make complete nanomedical systems, complete complex devices that are about 100 nanometers in diameter that will do very complex medical treatments. And I'll just show you very briefly on the way through what that involves. And that involves a lot of molecular sensing and things down, combining things at the nanoscale. We also use a lot of these things for stem cell isolation, and we just have some new grants we're starting up where we're doing stem cell reprogramming of adult stem cells, or induced pluripotent stem cells, as you may have heard of them in the news, for regenerative medicine. This is a replacement for organ transplants and things like that to literally regenerate tissues and organs in the human body. So this is not science fiction. This is happening, and we're going to be doing some of that over at Discovery Park here. And actually underway right now. So just as if you came over there in the Bindley, the first thing you would see is the macro devices. And I run a core facility for the university and the Purdue Cancer Center and a joint facility for the IU School of Medicine and Purdue. So we have a very large, expensive flow cytometer cell sorter, which will individually examine cells and then sort them. And these are live human cells, so we put them, they're considered a biohazard because of potential HIV infection or hepatitis. So you treat them that way. We have even a higher throughput quadrupole magnetic cell sorter that I'll mention this will do about 70,000 cells per second. And I was the original inventor of high-speed flow cytometry many, many years ago, first one to go up to what I call Mach 1, 100,000 cells per second. So we're getting close to that in commercial equipment. This one will go over a million cells per second, and we just, you know, this gets us into the range of actually doing autologous transplants, taking blood from your arm, picking out the stem cell precursors, re-engineering them for tissues, and then putting them back into you. And that will mean that you don't need to take immunosuppressive drugs if we can work that out. So you are your own transplant, which is the ideal transplant. And then we have a system here which allows us to actually literally sort of a Star Wars blasting cells. We can literally blast them out of existence when they're on a substrate. Or we can actually do something a little more sophisticated. We can shoot genes and other molecules into individual living cells at very, very high speeds. So I'll show you just really quick in passing. So all of this happens within the context of flow cytometry and cell separation, and then we're taking this the next step because we have to bring all the experiments to this, but what we really want to do is we'd like to bring the experiment in something roughly the size of a cell phone, and we're actually thinking cell phone technology, to actually have something essentially that's that big or bigger to be able to put it in something that you can put in your pocket and take out in the field, and there's some very good reasons why you would want to do that. Okay, so as I said, this gets into very high-speed measurements, and I wanted to put this in context because the commercial, these are machines that are, there's probably on the order of 50,000 flow cytometers and cell sorters in virtually every hospital and medical facility around the world. And for a long time, we've been shooting cells past laser beams through microfluidic structures. The heart of this is a microfluidic structure at speeds from 10 to 40 meters per second. This is through a microfluidic structure. That's pretty fast. And in contrast, most people who do lab-on-a-chip arrangements are down in the range of millimeters per second or a few centimeters per second. So there's a kind of a bad disconnect, and I've been trying to fill that void, because if you're going to do a lot of real biomedical applications at the micro scale, then you have to go much, much faster. And that puts a lot of demands on your optics, because you're sitting there trying to capture photons as desperately as you can as they go whizzing by. So this is, for 40 years, flow cytometry has had microfluidic structures in the middle. Everything else is macro around it. Very large, very expensive, very complicated structures. Can we make those small, portable, and cheap, and make them so everybody can basically have one and have things that are just disposable cartridge chips and things? So that's the segue from that. And again, even higher throughputs. And this is the one where you start thinking about, when I get into the imaging microchips, that you can start doing some fancy things. So use your imagination a little bit. Here we have galvanic mirrors, and we literally shoot cells, and we have a spot size, laser spot size about the size of a cell. So we can individually shoot cells at very, very high speeds. And it has robotics on it and so on. And this allows us to put molecules into cells, and this gives you an idea. So if we have a microwell, we can have the situation where we have a robotic reader here and cells inside that and galvanic mirrors, and we can actually... Okay, so here we're intersecting inside. If you watch carefully, we're going down in the well, and we're essentially zapping single cells. And so we can do very, very high cloning efficiency. And one of the applications we're doing with this is to actually do applications to find not only stem cells, but as some of you may or may have not heard, something called a cancer stem cell, which is a very primitive cancer cell that keeps regrowing. After you keep giving therapy for the more mature types, it keeps repopulating those. And so we're trying to do this for ways to go ahead and search for cancer stem cells. So the philosophy then is to go in here, we can choose on multiple properties, and then purify. Now all of this, if you look at this, you see what we do and then how we intersect with that. The next thing that we really want to do, which we have not started yet but we're about to, is to make a microfluidic flow-through chip that you can actually interact with the cells, and in fact, when you blast the cells away, to wash them away, for example, or bring fresh nutrients, so you can make complete microfluidic structures which sit in place of this little multi-well. And lastly, just because I'm going to show you some applications involving nanoparticles with micro devices. We make nanoparticles either with quantum dots or superparamagnetic iron oxide cores for nanomedicine. This is a complete nanomedical device, drug delivery device, complete with feedback control molecular biosensors to actually control essentially the drug delivery process. And as part of that, it allows us, so think of this as a medical device, except that it's about 100 nanometers across. And it delayers, and since the layers are controlled by the chemistry, these are actually what we call programmable nano devices. So programming, you're used to thinking this is a computer program. Programming is just controlling the sequence of events. So we're able to do that very, very nicely and do complex multi-step processes and do it under our control. So the neat thing about these devices is that we can put them inside a cell, and you can do drug delivery, or you can do something a little more creative than that. And by the way, as good engineers, you would never build a system without feedback control. In medicine, we do it all the time. There is no feedback control in most medicine therapies. So so one of the things we're trying to do is put the feedback control back in and truly engineer a nanomedical device. So here what we have is a molecular biocontrol switch. And if we, instead of delivering a drug, what if we were actually to put a manufacturing template for a drug inside a cell? Your cell has all the ingredients it needs to be able to produce a therapeutic gene to cure diseases. It just needs to know what order to put those RNA or DNA precursor molecules that you have inside your cell, just sitting there waiting around for the next cell cycle. So if you can put those in a template, have a biomolecular control switch, and actually read those out, then you have a complete functioning machine that actually senses whether that cell, so it's not only a way to treat, you've heard about treating individual patients with personalized medicine, but now we start to do single-cell medicine, massively parallel processing medicine at the single-cell level and manufacture to order inside each cell. Now, it sounds like science fiction. It's not. We've done it. Other people have done it. This just shows you an example where we've actually done that with, this is a switch which is always on that we put in, and these particles went in and produced a red product here inside this living cell. This is the more interesting one because it actually has a biomolecular control switch for oxidative stress proteins inside a cell. And this is this one right here. So this is a complete feedback loop. And we've actually, what we've done is we've put reporter genes of different colors in there so we can light them up and use them as a test sequence. But you could have a therapeutic gene in here. You've shown the feasibility of that. It's just swapping that out and putting another component in. So I'm going to go now from macro scale and walk us down into micro scale, into the main area of the talk here. And what I would say is going from those very big machines, the real revolution that's happened is the heart of the machine was always microfluidics. The problem was everything else was macro because that's the only way we knew how to do it. And you're aware of things, those of you who use optics may have photomultiplier tubes that may be, they've come from being very big things down to being somewhat smaller things. But we're talking about using, and I'll show you, we're using sensors that are about a millimeter across, complete, and they can detect down to single photon level with avalanche photodiode technology. So nanophotonic technology has really advanced. Digital signal processing, I'm going to show you in a minute, a complete rack of electronics that can be mostly replaced with a couple of chips. So we've had a real revolution in microelectronics also. So I wrote an article which I like to think was a sort of a prescient article in the field back in 2005, and it's called Ultra High Speed Cell Sorting because I'm the original inventor of that. And I was trying to say, that's fine, I can see where things are now, but where do they need to go in the future? And so one of the things that I presaged in there was I said, we've got to get away from these big massive machines and we've got to start making portable devices. And people kind of laughed at me and they said, well, you know, can you really do that? And so what I'm trying to show you today is we've already done part of that. And we're getting more and more, and I think people are now becoming believers that you can actually do this on the micro scale. So this is what, again, just sort of showing you, if you make a microfluidic cytometer measuring cells and possibly separating them, this is kind of what a general big macro sorter looks like. You basically take the cells and you flow them one at a time past a laser beam. You can have one or more laser beams here. And then you basically collect the fluorescence typically at 90 degrees from that. And this is essentially a liquid wire. It's a salt water solution. And we use radio frequency pulses to put a charge on this. If we want a cell that has a certain set of properties here that we measure fluorescence of those and then all the properties of that, complex properties, we can say we know how long it takes for a cell to go from here to here, and we can program in a delay. So this is roughly 1 millisecond from here to here. That's a long time. You can do some very complex calculations and decisions making in a millisecond. In fact, I did that 25 years ago, if you can imagine. They didn't have terabyte disk farms back then, so I had to make them fast. So when I first did this, I worked out some ways to do this extremely fast. But the problem with this, there's a couple of problems with this. When cell sorters were first made, they went quickly to an inkjet technology, similar to inkjet printers. This is basically an inkjet printer. And the reason was they could never figure out how to do anything. They thought the fastest switching times they could get with fluidic switching in microfluidics. The first sorters were actually microfluidic back 40 years ago, but they gave up on them. They walked away. And this is a classic thing, and I guess as a teaching lesson to you, whenever you think up something, a really good idea, it may not be able to be possible to be done with the current technology. What you've got to do sometimes is put that in the back of your mind and then bring it out again when these technologies, let everybody else work for you for a while and bring all those technologies you need up to speed. So the fastest switching times they were able to get were 1 millisecond switching times. So they immediately said, well, the fastest we can go is 1,000 cells per second. That's not fast enough. And if you do droplet inkjet printing, you can easily get yourself up to 5, 10, 20,000 cells per second quite easily. And so there was a whole revolution in cell sorters that went what we call droplet-based cell sorters. This worked out fine until about 1980, and we had a mysterious disease going around, which we now know is AIDS. Okay, and this was something that once AIDS hit the scene, then making aerosols and spraying aerosols out in the air with human material was not a very good thing to do. So what people did was, for many, many years, they did no live human cell sorting. Well, this, you know, why do sorting if you don't get live cells out? It's kind of a waste. And so what I showed you was at the beginning, one of the early slides was I showed you one of these kinds of cell sorters put inside a biohazard, a level 2 biohazard hood, so that it could contain the aerosols. You know, that's kind of a partial solution. Otherwise, people mask up and they put gowns on and they can get it can get pretty ugly in there. Because of the aerosol dangers, and hepatitis is a far bigger danger than HIV catching from aerosols. So anyway, so this technology was really limited. I pushed it to its max, as I said, up to over 100,000 cells per second, showed it could be done. That was important because we couldn't do some of the research we do now in human stem cell research and isolating stem cells like from your blood if we didn't have those kinds of speeds because they have to be that fast. So I had a lot of things that I put in there, a lot of smarts, and it ended up being a huge machine, about $1 million worth that would take up a good size of a room, definitely not portable. And it's a monster to teach somebody how to run it. So it takes, you know, if you take a smart graduate student and really train them hard, then maybe in 3 to 6 months they can learn how to run this thing. Well, that's kind of a killer in terms of productivity. So what we'd like to do is make something where we put all the smarts in the machine. So not only make this smaller, but put a lot of smarts in it so you have to configure everything. What you'd like to make is a device which will self-configure. Now, that may sound, again, like science fiction. It's not. You can sit there and sample things and then literally set the equipment, the blurring between hardware and software. Every device is kind of at the fuzzy stage between hardware and software, that you can have the device self-configure to be optimal so that you don't have to sit there and guess and spend a lot of time doing this. We can spend sometimes 2 or 3 hours setting this thing up to be able to run for 15 minutes. So it's not very practical, although I say a lot of things were invented there. So let's go into this immediately. Let's go from that giant cell sorter, and let's say we want to make a cell sorter that's at least portable, maybe the size of a shoebox, but it runs basically on battery power. What are the things you need to do that? Well, first thing I mentioned to you is you have some limitations, but you also have some opportunities. If you remember, what I had was a case of cells going single file past a laser beam. You say, why would you do that? Well, you'd do that if your laser cost about $80,000, for one thing, because you're not going to put 10 of them on there. It's going to get pretty costly. But what if you could replace that laser, that $80,000 laser, with a $10 or $20 LED? What if you could replace that PMT, which takes a lot of space, which may be $1,000 each, what if you could replace those for $100 or less in something that's very, very tiny and that can run off both of those run off batteries, by the way. So you start seeing how you can shrink things down to size. So we have a lot of collaborators. And when I first started thinking about that, I was in a place where I could think it up, but I couldn't build it. So people have asked me many times, why did you come to Purdue? I came to Purdue because they built Discovery Park for me, so that I could do my work. So I came up with a way of thinking about this, that because people said lab-in-a-chip stuff could never run fast. So I got into thinking about why shouldn't it be able to run fast? We've been running the lab-in-a-chips fast for 40 years, you know, coming from a different side view of things. So I came up with a way to do this and all the learning that's gone on in that period of time and found a way that conceivably we should be able to get a device, lab-in-a-chip device, that will operate easily in excess of 10,000 cells per second. Now, most of the literature you'll find 100 cells, 200 cells per second. So we're already up in a pretty good realm. But I really think you can run this thing, and I've scaled it. I've done a lot of modeling, simulation modeling of this, which I did with the other machine when I built it, that you should be able to go perhaps as much as 1 million cells per second with this, and I'll show you how. This gives you a way of thinking about things that when I show it to you, it will be almost absurdly obvious. You know, this is the embarrassment when you invent things. Most patents, you look at that and you say, why didn't somebody else think of that? This was pretty simple. So here's the idea. If you have a microfluidic device and you have a branching in this, it turns out that there's a cross-sectional area of this, and the cross-sectional area determines the spacing between different cells that are inside the structure and running through it. So as you go down through this thing, you can quickly convince yourself that if I go and I keep the cross-sectional areas, the sum of cross-sectional areas constant, so I don't get into pressure problems, then if I do that, then when I get down in these branches, I now have half the cross-section. So the spacing in the third dimension, namely along this path, will be twice as much. So the biggest problem you have in throughput is getting a separation between cells. Here they're too close together, but if I give up trying to do a single cell analysis at this point and I say, I don't care, I can do 100 cells at a time and I can just see if there's one cell in the 100 that's of interest to me. And if there is, I'll grab the whole 100 cells and then re-examine them down the next stage. Well, this is a pattern we call enrichment sorting. It's been around for close to 30 years. I was one of the first people to do it. And what you can quickly convince yourself is that when you do that, and again, model it and actually do the experiments, you can reduce the amount of time that it takes to do an experiment and to sort, analyze and sort a certain number of cells by an order of magnitude. Now, I can tell you, this made the graduate students and postdocs really happy. Okay, to be able to go from, I had a postdoc that started this work that it took him 6 hours to run each sample. And if anything went wrong in a few seconds, it was over and he started all over again, another 6 hours. So we made the original system. We put a lot of sophisticated controls because you can't have these devices that work on human scale with a tenth of a second reaction, panic button time. You know, at 100,000 cells a second, with a tenth of a second, you know, 10,000 cells have gone in the wrong place. It's over. Your evening is over. Now you're working real graduate student hours. You know, no longer from after supper till midnight. Now it's midnight to dawn. So we ended up doing something that allowed him to do more reliably the same experiment in 15 minutes or less. So needless to say, this made as I said, the graduate students and postdocs really happy. So what I'm indicating is that what we had to do is we had to take the cells then out we only had a one stage with these big devices. We had to take those cells out after the first stage and then put them back in the top and then sort them a second time to be able to get them more pure. They got enriched the first time, but there was still contaminants. So then when you think about that problem, you say, well, gee, you know, if I don't have the constraint, sort of the von Neumann problem with the laser beams where I have $80,000 lasers, if I have a $10 light source, why don't I put 100 of them in and start thinking of this? So everybody starts thinking in parallel. But what I'm telling you is use your imagination. This isn't parallel. What I'm going to convince you is that this is an exponentially staging device. That's very important because otherwise it would scale. If it were parallel processing, it would scale arithmetically. So if I want to go 100 times faster, I have to have 100 devices. What I'm going to show you here is by the time you get to a four-stage device, if you have a 1 millisecond switching time, you'd say, oh, that's 1,000 cells per second. I'm hopefully going to convince you that by the time you do four levels of this deep, you can have a device which will have a total throughput of close to 1 million cells per second, exponentially staging. So we're actually building these, testing these, and this is the theory. Again, as you go down through stages, you see we start out with a lot. This is the partition interval. So we have a light source and a detector which illuminates this volume, this volume, this volume, and you start seeing how we're partitioning. So here we have lots of cells. Here we may have two. Here we get down very quickly to one cell, and I'd convince you that almost at any speed, by the time we get down four levels, we're doing single cell analysis, which is the goal of cytometry, so we can see what every single cell is doing and separate it, so we can do lots of different separations simultaneously. And this ends up being, as you model this and actually do it, an exponentially staging device. So my graduate student has been working on this for a couple of years now, and she's built a two-stage device like this and looked at all kinds of different angles and devices, a standard PDMS device. And What we're doing with this PDMS device is making a sandwich arrangement. So if you think about this, that the entire 4 levels deep cell sorter would fit on the face of your cell phone. You'd have a chip which would go in, basically, your PDMS chip that would go in there, and you'd be able to throw it away after you finished using it. You have light sources. You can have them on both sides. You can have LEDs on one side and avalanche photodiodes on the other side. And your cell inputs in the third dimension. And you can even have little reagent pools, things that you plug in for different reagents to do different things. So it turns out you start to use the real estate in here really tightly, but it's possible to make a sandwich structure which has all of these things. And the other thing that I think that Steve has asked me to mention to you is that when you start thinking as a mechanical engineer to do something useful, you frequently have to go out to other fields and you have to make integrated devices. So what I'm going to show you here are very integrated devices from several different fields that you have to put all these things together. Okay, but mechanical engineers have I'm a mere aerospace engineer. And as I said, aerospace engineers we only have to be good enough to make things fly. You guys have to be able to make them also go on land and sea. So here's the basic structure. It kind of looks like this. You start having small devices that you bring in. You can make this even smaller by using larger devices and slit structures, and we're doing that right now, so you can make very precise illumination widths and so on, and you can also use avalanche photodiode arrays. So you can actually have smaller number of devices, but just do the readouts in a different way. So this is just, again, saying that the whole thing is dictated by queuing theory. Why would we do that? It's because I showed you the two-stage model that we have. What we have to prove to people is that exactly what I've told you to believe is in fact experimentally the case. In other words, that the spacings do respace themselves according to this, and then with the switching times, that we can then predict the performance of any device that we're going to be able to build. So we're trying to do that, and I've done a lot of queuing theory models, but you can imagine this one with all of this exponential architecture is going to be a very complicated model. But it's the same, the queuing theory is the same theory that is like your customer lines in your grocery store, you know, the speeds at which you go through. So here, if we start thinking about making integrated BioMEMS optical devices, the first thing that we have some challenges and some solutions. So eliminating large and expensive and non-portable light sources. These superluminescent LEDs are up in the milliwatt ranges now. And a milliwatt or two is plenty for us to do if we do good optical coupling to the actual devices. So these are very small right now and very bright, very cheap. Get rid of the aerosol-based inkjet printing technology and go to disposable microfluidic-based closed devices. So everything is closed. It's safe. So if you're going to handle human bloods, you can do that safely. And then this idea of getting rare cells. And it was a passion of mine at the beginning of my career to look at very rare cells that are present. Many of you have, and I don't want to alarm you, but you may have cancer cells in your body circulating in your blood at frequencies of like 1 in a million with respect to your white blood cells. Your immune system normally handles those things. But when we have cancer patients, we want to be able to, first of all, find things at that level, and second, we'd like to be able to monitor those. So that, for example, we have in human breast cancers, we have the case where the genes may mutate and suddenly become very much more dangerous, and the therapy may completely change. And if we don't know that, we lose the patient because the patient comes roaring out of remission. And I know you guys may not be interested in this, but you probably have girlfriends and mothers and other people who are undergoing some of this. So it's a huge problem. And so we have to be able to monitor for what these gene rearrangements are in these very rare cells, which are present in frequencies on the order of 1 in a million. And demonstrated a variety of methods to be able to actually find those. So again, here's some things. You start putting this together, you say, okay, if I have small LEDs, I can make objects. I can look at objects from 1 to about 20 microns very easily. That's nice because that says I can work on most human fluids. With this, I can also work even at the bacterial range. I'm sort of at the at the high end of this. And with the detectors, I can make these very, very sensitive, and I'm going to show you ways that we can also solve their noise problems. We can make objects move. We're typically running at about, on the order, slow speed for us is 100 centimeters per second. Typically, we run about a meter per second. And we have to think about that because we're gathering photons from these probes that we put on cells as we go through. So you can solve this. There's dynamic range problems. We can bond things directly. And then we can have continuous, or it could be pulsed. And we can now have, with digital circuitry, we can solve dynamic range problems. One of the problems we have when we measure things on human cells is we have at least four orders of magnitude difference in the numbers of molecules present of particular types in cells. And it's important, sometimes five or six orders of magnitude. That creates huge problems for electronics to handle that kind of dynamic range very, very quickly. So we now have come a long way. I can remember when these were 8-bit, and now 24-bit allows us to do some pretty significant things. Now, we're starting out, in the lab, we can do rapid prototyping. This one's done. We do a combination of this is a Pixie system from National Instruments where we do prototyping in lab view. We also have some MATLAB arrangements. We want to do that first before we get deeply into chips that are going to take a lot of time. So this is a rapid prototyping. And once we do that, we work with Pedro Arathoki's lab. Pedro does a lot of microelectronics. And so you can have your avalanche photodiodes for your signal detection. Now this gets very expensive, application-specific integrated circuit chips. You know, you can spend $50,000 easy for the original template for that. And then you can make, of course, a lot of copies. Digital signal processing, you saw that whole rack of electronics we had. It was kind of embarrassing. We built the world's first neural network flow cytometer cell sorter, where we made complete multivariate statistical functions on the fly. This is the stuff that you hate to do in statistics classes. Well, we're actually doing this to classify cells to make sort decisions to separate out different types of cells, like cancer cells and stem cells and so on. So that most of that rack of electronics, a good deal of it could be replaced by a few chips here. And you can program, as I said, that blurs the line between hardware and software, control logic. At the heart of all this, again, everything, the heart of it's coming through with the microfluidics because that's where everything comes together. So this is just showing you how the pieces start to come together with this. So again, we do the photolithography in the Burke Nanotechnology Center. And this just shows you, I wanted to show you because this is a fairly slow flow rate in this picture, and it looks like it's not going to be very visible in here. But the take-home message on this is that we can go to very, very high velocities and speeds through this, and we think we can go easily a meter per second through these multi-stage chips, which is pretty fast and possibly more than that. So I'm going to go ahead and give it a try and see if this movie works. Can we lower those down a little bit? I think that would help. If you promise not to sleep. As I say, no students sleep on my watch. It's my job to keep you awake. So you can see the branch structure here. So you see the Y-shaped structure. And I'm just going to run a very brief movie here. And then, so you see the cell, in this case, these are beads coming down through. You see the red beads? So it's a little hard for you to envision that. I'll just play that again. But over on the right-hand side, perhaps you can see that I've got two beads right here with a certain spacing. And then as they start going down one of these branches, look what happens to the spacing. And if you actually compute this, the average spacing comes out just in the ratio of the cross-sections of those different channels as we split, just as I told you. So obviously you have to do a whole bunch of those and see if it really fits the model. But this allows us to experimentally check the queuing theory models. And here I'm going to show some that are running very fast. You probably won't even see those ones on this side. They're going very fast. And here they're going much more slowly. So this is roughly 10 times as fast here. So this looks like they're zipping pretty fast. That should also look very similar to what goes through your blood vessels. That's how fast your red blood cells go through some of your capillaries. Okay. Now, we've tried doing some sorting structures, and Steve's group has helped. Why don't we keep it like this for now? Maybe a little bit. Thank you, Steve. So you say, well, if you want to use valving structures, here's one way to do it. You can make an elastomeric valve, like with PDMS, and actually push it down in. And here's this is courtesy of one of Steve's graduate students here. And here what you see is that you're pushing down in. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to do that manually just to show you. But you get the idea that you're pushing down and you're trying to block the channel, but it turns out it's hard. You don't want to block all the fluid. You just want to block the cells from going down one channel so that they get diverted down another channel. So it's a partial opening and closing. Now think about doing that on a millisecond basis and sort of shifting back and forth between every branch point, between a right and a left, and doing that very, very fast. And you've got to know what's coming downstream. So upstream, you have to know the identity of the cell, and you have to wait just the amount of time. You have to start closing the valve so it make it go down one branch, and then the cell behind it, you may want to go the other way. So you're sitting there doing some complicated switching. We've done that for many, many years with the droplet-based technology, but doing it with microfluidics, it gets a little bit more challenging. So we've tried that. We're not very happy with our results yet. We've got a long way to go, but I just wanted to point that out to you as a direction that we are going. So the other thing, that avalanche photodiodes used to be all in the infrared part of the spectrum, which was almost useless to us for most of the fluorescent probes that we use in medical applications are in the blue-green part of the spectrum, or orange, red, and so on, visible part of the spectrum. And they have low gains, most avalanche photodiodes. So this is a new one. We're working with Sensil Technologies in Cork, Ireland. They make probably some of the best avalanche photodiodes right now. They have a low bias, so you only need 30 volts, and you can do that essentially easily from a battery arrangement. So you don't need 1,000 volts like you typically do on, or even 2,000 volts what we used to use for photomultiplier tubes. So you can run this thing off a battery. And the spectral characteristics are great. So one of the things that we did with that, and people argue, said, well, they're too noisy. So we worked with another Byung-Hyo Jung's lab, and what we did was we basically developed what's called a sigma-delta. Everybody does transimpedance signal processing for these devices. They've been doing that for 40 years, and it turns out that that itself is noisy. They just didn't realize it. So the sigma-delta method, which I don't have time to go into detail with you, but it suffices to say that what we can do is we can go in and take what looks like a noisy signal and very fast pick out the relevant components of that and get rid of most of the noise, and we've published some of that. And that allows us to do sensitivities that people didn't think were possible. And so we've gotten down to levels of 100 molecules of fluorescein. Now, the best big macro machines right now with the transimpedance amplifiers will brag that they've got 300 or 400 molecule detection per cell that they can see, 300 or 400 molecules sensitivity. So we're coming along with a battery-powered device with supposedly noisy components that say we can do 100. Now, that doesn't mean that ours is really better. I mean, if they did something like this on their device, they'd probably do better than us. But they'd be down to like 50 to 100, but they just have never done that before. We had to do this because we had to get through noise problems, noise issues. So we've worked out a lot of these arrangements. And we've done the digital signal testing, and this one originally is the digital signal processing board with MATLAB algorithms, and this is a fairly slow one here. But we've shown we've been able to make a count. This is like number of beads and fluorescent intensity. And we're able to show, we actually split a signal off the macro sorter and then put it also, its signal processing device, and went through the micro digital signal processing chip. So here's one chip basically handling what that good part of that rack of electronics was doing and coming up with essentially almost identical results, comparison between the two. Okay, so let's now put this to a practical and say, well, what good is this? We've shown in general that we can make a microfluidic device that does something similar to a macro device. But let's get into something very practical that we want to actually make a blood analyzer, and blood analyzer for NASA to do up on the space station. So here's a statement of the problem, that NASA really needs to monitor the health of astronauts. But And the problems that you have are infections. A lot of infections you carry up with you and they get reactivated in ultra-low gravity. Anemia is a problem. Astronauts, as they stay in space for months, and some of them do on the space station now, they develop symptoms similar to AIDS in terms of their immune deficiency. So it's really, it's something that we really need to understand better. So here they are up on the space station. This is a relatively recent photo of the International Space Station. But sampling of astronauts' blood in space is still done like it was done 40 years ago. This is back in the Apollo era. Actually, this was a space lab era, 1973. They still do it like they do on the ground, stick a needle in you. You've all been through that. And you can imagine trying to process that blood in space because, things tend to go everywhere in ultra-low gravity. So this is not a very good way. And in fact, the ironic thing is it's never actually processed in space. All they do is take blood samples, sort of keep them cold or freeze them down, and then bring them back down to Earth and then analyze them after the mission's over. Well, you say, well, this is a shocking fact. You may or may not know this. But the space shuttle and the International Space Station have less medical capability than your average ambulance around here in West Lafayette. And I'm not kidding. I'm deadly serious when I say that. There's almost no medical capabilities. Why? Because all they've planned for is if anybody gets in any kind of sickness, they bring them back down on the ground. But bringing them back on the ground is very, very expensive, right? First of all. Second of all, if you're going to Mars or out to the asteroid belt, which may be the alternative that we're going to do next, they aren't going to come back if they get sick. They have to treat them. So you have to know medically what your tests are. They have no ability to do that. And to do this with the traditional way would be big machines, and it's at $10,000 a pound to launch something into space. You don't want to put a structure up there that weighs 300 pounds. It takes up a lot of room. So what you'd like to do is make some. So we're making something about the size of a book, literally, that's completely battery-powered, maybe up to a couple of pounds, and it's completely portable. But we get rid of all of this step. Say, why draw the blood out and do all this other stuff with it? Why don't you just take the blood right into the device and be done with it? So that's what we've done. We've actually made a device. This shows you a CAD program. We've actually designed this already, and we're actively building prototypes. So we have whole blood coming in, and what we have is a device where you basically have is actually a little pin pricker thing on the top of it. You put your finger on it, and it will, by capillary action, take up one drop of blood. That's all you need is one drop of blood to do this. When the blood goes in the chip, it starts out as whole blood, and there's a variety of devices. I'll show you that in a few minutes. And the idea is you want to make the white blood cells go down one channel so you can analyze them and count them, get a white blood cell count, get a red blood cell count. And this is, you might say, why branch the red blood cells? It's because this is an application that I think I'm the only person in the world that's ever done anything close to this. And that is we're running a whole blood roughly diluted by a factor of 10. That's over 100,000 cells per second down this channel. And we don't want to try to make a handheld device that runs 100,000 cells a second. So if we sample the sample by making a subset cross-sectional area tube, we might be able to get that down to a few thousand cells per red blood cells per second. So it's a standard way that we do things to overcome problems. So here's what it actually looks like. So this is what we're building for NASA, is something that comes in. We looked at the problem of saying, gee, the valving structures are complex. We want something really simple, really reliable. Instead of making valves, why don't we put the valve on the cell? So here what we've got is a magnet, and if we put magnetic nanoparticles on the cells, on the white blood cells specifically, using antibodies, then just by putting a permanent magnet here, we can make all the white blood cells go down this channel, and the red blood cells will go down the rest of this. So we've already done a separation without having to do any timing, any fractionation. It's real simple, be real reliable. And then here we're using nanoparticles, quantum dot nanoparticles, and we can essentially excite multiple wavelengths of multiple colors of nanoparticles, each one which can have a different antibody on it. And for example, you want to know if an astronaut has infections, you look for neutrophils. You want to know how their B cells are doing, so if they're making antibodies and things, how their T cells for the status of their immune system. You can test almost anything you want. and you can excite with one wavelength, sitting here with a nice little superluminescent LED, you can get up to 5 colors of fluorescence. So here's what the integrated device looks like. So we have a reagent module here, a microsyringe, so when it first comes in, capillary action, then you have sample mixing here, you bring it down to the chip, these chips are disposable, there's a light source with some slits, your fluorescent emission filters and your avalanche photodiode here, and your digital signal processing. And all of that fits into something a little like a modest sized book with everything in there, including the power sources. And does this kind of thing work? Well, here's the magnet over here, and we've got cells coming now, or where the magnet will be, I should say. Now, when we put a magnet there, you see the cells are going down. These are actual cells. These are white blood cells. And here we see in 3 separate frames where we've now taken a magnet here. Here it is. Here it is at a later point in time and a later point in time. So we've essentially diverted it down this path. It works very, very simple, very, very reliable. Now, you say, that's kind of a limited market, making something for the astronauts in space. But if you start thinking about this, you say, no, this is a huge market. Because we're taking a drop of blood from the astronauts in space because we don't want to have to fractionate red blood cells from white blood cells. We don't have all the equipment up there. But the astronauts have a lot of blood. What we have is a common case. The average newborn baby only has, you have on the order of about 5,000 to 7,000 milliliters or cc's of blood, each of you in this room. The guys are up in this range and the women are typically down this range. That's a lot of blood compared to a baby, which is 100 to 200 mils. A premature baby will have only 100 mils of blood total. So you don't take a 10 mil blood sample from a baby. That may seem obvious to you. Guess what? There are no pediatric blood devices right now. I kid you not. They've never been developed. So what happens right now is when a newborn is tested, they do a heel prick for PKU test. This is a phenylketonuria, which is a metabolic disease. So if you can test for the baby having PKU, then you can prevent mental retardation and other things by diet control. So now they're doing more and more from that one drop of blood, but all from plasma. There is no analysis of the cells, the blood cells coming out of that heel prick. None. Okay? So what we want to do is we say, well, if there's one drop of blood, trust me, I used to be also a pediatrics professor. There's generally going to be two drops of blood there anyway. So let's take the second drop and do a complete blood analysis right after the baby's born. So you literally can be in the operating room with a portable device, take the one drop of blood, and within on the order of 10 minutes, maybe 15 at the outside, have a complete analysis of the baby's blood. So you know whether the baby is immune deficient, they may be susceptible to infectious diseases, whether they're anemic, they may need immediate treatments for anemia. There's a lot of different tests you can do. So that's what we're trying to do, and this is every baby born in America has a heel prick. But right now, not much really done with that. So we've gone from space to the newborn operating room. Okay, so let's go with the final application here. Let's take the other device. This is a different kind of device. You've all heard about the problems with pathogens on spinach and lettuce and problems like that. And I think we should get more and more and more concerned about pathogens because food is coming to us from all around the world. And where there's pesticides, there's all kinds of things in there, and it's not tested. In general, I mean, it's kind of a frightening thing. All the stuff you put in your body, you trust that it's okay. You buy it at the store and it's supposed to be okay. How do you know it's okay? You know, at some point, you'd like to say, hey, somebody actually looked at this and it really doesn't have any pathogens. There's no testing technology for that now. We just finished a conference earlier this week, USDA conference at Purdue. There is no testing technology out in the field right now. And so again, what we'd like to do is have a testing technology. Now you really get into your telephone technology because you could be out in the field, take a sample in the field, and not only you could have a GPS device in it, would tell exactly where you were. It could telemetry. This is a complete telemetry device. It can send all the data to a central station instantaneously. So you could actually track where everything is actually happening. So this is doable. Just that until recently, they haven't been interested in doing that. But now they are. So we're trying to make a portable cytometer for microbes this time, pathogens. And we want to be able to do right now, metabolic tests require 2 to 7 days. So you can guess what happens in 2 to 7 days. That's why the peanut butter goes from the field to the shelf at the grocery store and you get your salmonella infection from the peanut butter because nobody tested it. Okay? And PCR tests, that's a polymerase chain reaction, is a way to amplify the DNA and the RNA. It's expensive. It still takes hours and it's very tedious. Flow cytometry, I think I've already convinced you, is very expensive instrumentation, at least the macro stuff. ELISA is another way, can take many hours. And because of the time delay, and this is a central theme that I want to make for portable point-of-care type devices, whether it be a medical thing or a food thing, is the problem is you have to make decisions. And you can't wait hours or days. You have to make a decision, let's say, in the next 10 or 15 minutes as to what to do next. So it doesn't help to send a test off that's going to take 7 days. All right? So this is why we're trying to make point-of-care devices and why a lot of you as mechanical engineers are well-situated to do this kind of thing. So here's some requirements. We have to have something that's battery-powered and sturdy, can take it out in the field, small and compact. It has to take rapid sampling. And here's the real kicker is, and this is something we'll come back to again, a microfluidic device, by definition, takes microvolumes. So if you're trying to sample something that's a rare pathogen in a large volume, let's say you have 100 cc's of fluid, 100 cc's of fluid does not through a microfluidic flow cell go, all right? You have to do some pre-concentration. So we and other groups have worked out, there's a lot of people working particularly Mike Laddish's group here at Purdue, working on ways to concentrate the pathogens at least 1,000 to 10,000 fold so that you get microvolumes. But that's an important part of the problem. So it has to be chip-based, so you don't have any cross-contamination between tests. You can make PDMS chips for pennies. They're very, very cheap. You want to be multiplex, because when you're looking for pathogens, it's unlike, you know, in the lab, when we build these things, we know exactly what we put in, and then we go look for it. Okay? That's kind of cheating. All right? When we're really out in the real world, we may have, you know, I'll come back to this later, but you could have hundreds of different pathogens, and because of that, you don't know which one it is. So what you'd like to have is what we call a multiplex detection scheme, one where you can test for, let's say, 100 different pathogens simultaneously. Okay, so there's some very easy ways to do that, as it turns out. And one of those ways, this is sort of what we call a label-free method, is surface plasmon resonance. That can measure small changes in dielectric properties. So we can tell if a pathogen, we can measure things down as small as a virus, so well below the optical limit with this, and actually test presence of that. So here's what surface plasmon resonance is about, basically usually used with gold spots, but it can be any metallic material will have some plasmon resonance detection. And what you're doing is you're shining a laser beam off it, and then instead of it reflecting off that, you're actually converting the reflected light. The momentum of the photons is transferred to plasmons, which go actually through the metal. And here's basically what you've got. So we're shining a light off, typically through a prism, this so-called Creshman configuration. I'll show you why we have to do that. And then as we shine it off, here's the normal thing, that some of the energy that we put up to this surface is effectively bled off into this metal film. So the amount of light reflected is less than the amount that goes in. So you can actually measure that. Now, if we bring something like a pathogen close to the surface, what it does is it interferes with this. And so we actually get more light reflected back out again. So we can detect the presence of something. And it's a very severe angle-dependent thing. So we measure at an angle roughly on the order of, say, 53 degrees for if you had this wavelength of light. And so here's what we're building for a device. We call a hybrid device. It's a hybrid surface plasmon resonance device at the bottom. So all we need, this sounds complicated and expensive, it isn't. Because the laser you have here is, this laser pointer would be more than enough energy, and it's battery powered, okay, off the bottom surface. So it's a non-contact. So here's your food pathogens and a fluid, typically water washing it through here. Here's a little CCD camera. Those are getting real cheap because of your little portable cameras, including in your cell phones. It's amazing how you piggybacked all these other technologies. You know, we have a revolution in CCD cameras because they're everywhere now, very cheap. And then the top of the chip, we make a fluorescence device with some optical filter arrangements, and again, another little CCD camera. So the bottom of it, we can tell, for example, whether we have an E. coli species that's pathogenic. At the bottom, the top of it, we can tell the status of that, like if it's live or dead. Or as I tell college students, it's a question of when you go to McDonald's, you know, what are you getting? You know, if you're getting the hamburger with the bacteria, if the bacteria are alive, it's dangerous. If the bacteria are dead, hey, you've got they threw in some free protein for you, no cost. So, but you need to know the status. So what we've made, it turns out, because we have to do this angular thing, we've built a system. Here's the general design. So we have a little fluidic chip that goes in here so the things can flow in. They can be captured in an array here, which I'll show you in just a minute. So you slide the chip in. We have a CCD camera, a laser here. So that's off the bottom of the chip. Here's some optical assemblies here and an LED light source and a CCD camera at the top. This is completely portable. Again, not as small as we'd like to make it, but this is a complete optical prototyping. Does away with an optical bench. So what we would have is a normal big optical bench. We now have this complete portable rack, and these angles are rigid. You can carry this thing around. It's lightweight. Okay? And we're making chips. We actually do two things. One is we have to make the array elements. Again, little gold spots. Right now we're using commercial chips. You can buy these. And then we're doing microfluidic assemblies with PDMS that you put over the top of it, and then you assemble those things so you have a flow-through device. So you then, each of these little array elements, now I show six of them here, I'm going to show you a 4x4, but in fact, each of these could have separate peptides or antibodies to capture very specifically a pathogen. So by making an array, and you know exactly what's on each array element, and you say, how do I do this? We actually have robotic spotters that can sit there and do this thing at blind, you know, blazing speed to actually manufacture these things. Obviously, we're not in manufacturing mode yet, but it's very easy to spot these arrays, and so you know exactly what you've got where. And then you capture. So here may be a bacterium that you've captured. And I'm just going to go rapidly to this. And we want to make sure, so in this case, that the pathogens come down close enough to the surface, so we actually make it made a tapered microfluidic chip. So we've gone from a river to making a dam, okay, so that we spread the water out to a lower depth so it has time to capture, and then we can make the stop flow, let it capture, and then let more flow through and wash away things that are unbound. We can pre-concentrate, and this just shows you if we use magnetic nanoparticles with other capture agents out there, and there's a variety of ways you can do this. This just shows you very crudely, these are bacteria that we've labeled E. coli with magnetic beads. So you see a slurry of these things, and now here are the bacteria pulled away with a magnet. Now obviously we wouldn't use a magnet like this, we'd use an electromagnet. We could turn on or off so we could release it. So here we'd have an electromagnet, capture them, get rid of all the fluid, bring a very small amount of fluid in, take the magnet away, and then concentrate the sample. We've done that successfully to be somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000-fold reduction in volume. This just shows you real quickly these particular things. If we have, this is the nasty E. coli 0157H7 that's caused deaths in the United States and elsewhere on spinach and lettuce, a very nasty pathogen. We grow that in our lab. That's why we don't allow you to bring your lunch into our lab. Okay, and then across this top row here, we've applied that E. coli. We have the antibody on the blue chip arrays here. So these are little array elements. We have essentially a negative control and then a very negative control with the red and the yellow. So if you look at this, you say only the places with the positives should be the ones that have this star on them. So these three, so here you are, and indeed these are the experimental data. You see a little bit on this other, but we don't just look at that. What we do is we have a little image, use NIH's ImageJ software, free software package, very rapid, easy analysis of that. And if you actually look at this, say, how good is the signal to noise on this? Here's what happens when you actually graph this. So it's very, very specific, huge signal-to-noise ratios, and these should be about the same as being nonspecific. So you can do this very, very quickly. And we can tell the viability of this with a so-called backlight kit. So here we have all of these, and we have about 97% viable. So if these were in your McDonald's burger, you don't want to eat this one. Okay? But this particular one, we only have 1%, 3% dead. So this could also test us, did they cook their burger thoroughly? Did they go from it being 3% dead to 100% dead, which is what you'd like it to be? So you could actually have a way of testing that. So here's just shows you SPR images, fluorescent images, and I'm getting close to the end here. And then we can image things down. These are individual beads at low magnification. And we can make a hybrid device. So we've actually patented this. I encourage students in my lab to. We've gotten 2 patents in the last year with graduate student patents and starting to publish this. And what I want to show you here is, you say again, food pathogen testing. You know, believe it or not, there will be food companies that will do this because they'll be able to put a sticker on saying, you know, our food has been tested to be pathogen free. You know, when you're in an environment where you're not sure what the status of your food is, that can be really important. But when you go down to that, let's think about one that's even more common, because this is something that you may have experienced, but here's one that I'm sure you've experienced. How many times have you gone to your doctor? Okay, you got a sore throat, sniffly nose, you're sneezing, and the doctor puts this wooden... This has been the same way for 40 years, 50 years now, okay? So they put a tongue depressor on, they tell you to say, ah, and the doctor looks in with a flashlight, you know, looks and says, yep, or nope. And sometimes they see something really ugly in the back of your throat, not to despoil your dinner. But what they do, they take this swab, and they go in there and they swab some of this stuff, and then they streak it on agar plates like they did 40, 50 years ago. It hasn't changed. But here's the problem. You're in the doctor's office, and now you're trying to get out of the doctor's office with some kind of treatment or diagnosis. The doctor looks, and basically, if it looks starts to look pretty red, they say, well, I'm not sure. How many times they say, I'm not sure this is bacterial, but I'm going to give you some antibiotics, meaning I don't know what it is. Okay? And this is why we overuse antibiotics, and in many cases, it may be something different. And we have no idea what it is. And we even have antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria in your throats now because we've over-abused antibiotics. So you streak this plate, and guess what? You streak that plate, and typically 3 to 5 days later, they find out, okay, and if you've had something serious like a strep infection or whatever, it can be that you're either dead or you're better, okay? Not a very good system. So what would you like to have? You'd like to be able to do this swab here, and do just like I showed you in that pathogen testing device for food, put that in a very small amount of fluid, run it in your chip, test for hundreds of microbes. Now, why do I say hundreds of microbes? I'm going to spoil your weekend social activities. Each of you has on the order of 400 to 600 different species and strains of microbes in your mouths. And they're not all the same. And you share them on occasion. So with this would allow us to actually test and look and see. Most of them are harmless. This would allow us to do a rapid test so that you could have a test literally. This is the kind of test that could be done in 10 minutes in the doctor's office with a swab. And then the doctor would say, hey, you know, you do have a bacterial infection, but you know, your bacteria is resistant to the common type of antibiotic, so I'm going to give you this other type of antibiotic that's going to work better. Okay? Or he's going to tell you, I'm sorry, it's antiviral and we don't have anything to do that, but as long as we, and typically they give you antibiotics when you have viral ones anyway, because they're worried about secondary infections. But they can do something at least a little bit more planned than you would normally. So this is a very common one and I think would have a lot of social uses. So with that, I just say these are some publications if you're interested. Again, all student publications, and these are many, many, many collaborators that we have with my lab. Maggie Grafton has been doing the blood analyzer work. That's part of her PhD thesis. And Mike Zordon has been doing the work with the pathogen detector device. And you see a lot of these people are from electrical, mechanical, and other departments. So we use many, many collaborators and all the other collaborators for all the things I haven't talked to you about today. So I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have. And we might want to, I guess, let people go because the hour's late. But I'm happy to stay and answer questions.